Okay, so just to finish the couple of slides that we couldn't finish last time, we were talking about I/O devices. If you remember, I started talking about how most of these devices are built. I said devices have ports. Each device has four, typically the simplest form of an I/O device has four registers, a register to write a command, a register to read the status of what happened to your command, a register to write data, and a register to read data. Okay, we talked about how you can communicate with such devices using polling, said how can you communicate with I/O devices using interrupts, and we said both of these mechanisms are only effective for one byte at a time communication. So if you need to send larger chunks of data, you use direct memory access or DMA. Okay? That's the gist of what we were talking about last time. There's one additional small concept to cover, and then we'll be done with I/O devices, and that has to do with buffering. Okay? So as we have said, I/O devices are slow, as you probably have heard again and again, and there has to be something the operating system does to optimize the performance of slow I/O. Okay, and this is typically handled using buffering. Typically, you have buffers or memory on both the device itself as well as in the operating system kernel, where some of the data from the device is kept. Okay, and you will use these buffers or caches to optimize performance. Okay, when we talked about hard disk, I said typically there is 4 to 8 megabytes of on-disk memory. Okay, this is where you can read entire tracks into the disk buffer at a time, or if you want to write a whole chunk of data, you can bring it into the buffer and then write it to whatever tracks you want or cylinders you want and so on. Okay, so we'll look at what kinds of optimizations you can do. Okay, from as far as the device is concerned. So I'm going to draw a picture here. Okay, so there's the disk. There is a disk cache or disk buffer here. Okay, and then that's the. Okay, here is the OS. Okay, the OS will also have a buffer cache, which is stored in main memory. Okay. So what happens is when requests come in, let's say it's a read request, what you would do is you would first check if the data you're trying to read is already in the buffer cache, because some other request has previously accessed that data. Okay, if it's already in the buffer cache, you don't need to go back to the I/O device, in this case the disk, and read that data again. Okay, it's already cached, so you can just go into the cache, pull that data out and return it to the application that requested it. Okay, and if it is not in that buffer cache, then you have to send it off to the hard disk. When you send it off to the hard disk, there's another cache on that disk at the memory, because if the disk has done a read ahead and the data is already in that cache, then again you don't need to go to the disk. You read it from that cache, you bring it into the OS buffer cache, and you return it to the user. Okay, so you have these levels of caches that are used to reduce the slow I/O, or reduce the performance impact of slow I/O. Okay? So the first reason to have these buffer caches is to cope with speed mismatches. The devices are slow, CPU is fast, you put some cache in between, you store frequently accessed data in that cache, and that helps improve application performance. Okay. The second reason to have these caches is to deal with mismatches in the sizes of data chunks that the OS may be writing and the device may be used to. Okay, so for instance, if you have a Linux file system, let's say ext3 or ext2, it will have a typical block size of 1 to 4 kilobytes. Okay. Now, as far as disks go, the sector sizes are 512 bytes. As far as the disk is concerned, the minimum granularity of data you read or write, 512 bytes. As far as the file system is concerned, the minimum granularity of data you can read or write is between 1 or 4 kilobytes. That's the file system block size. Okay, let's say it's 1 kilobyte. So because the sizes are different, okay, if you want to read or write these chunks of data, you actually keep the additional data you may end up reading or writing in one of these caches. Okay, so caches also allow you to, so if you want to write a file system block that will, that's, let's say, 4 kilobytes in size, that is 8 consecutive sectors as far as the disk is concerned. Okay, those are, this would be 8 individual requests. So you have to take one file system write request that get partitioned into 8 disk IO requests as far as sectors are concerned. So to deal with all of this translation and mismatches, you also use your buffer caches. Okay, and last but not least, buffers also help you to minimize the time user processes block on writes. Okay? Because you, what you can do is, I'll talk about this form of caching in just a moment. If you have what are called write back caches rather than write through caches, if you want to send a disk IO request, you can just copy it to the OS buffer cache or to the disk memory and return back to the user process saying your request is done. Okay? In reality, it's not done. It's still in progress, but you just sent it off to the device or sent it to the buffer cache, and it is going to get written asynchronously at a later time. Okay? This will also speed up the write performance. So you don't actually wait for the write to complete. You just copy it into some memory, whether this OS buffer cache memory or the disk onboard disk memory, and then you basically return back to the user process. Okay? This will also speed up the write performance. Okay, so that's a performance reliability trade-off, because the user process thinks the write is done, but it's actually still ongoing as far as the system is concerned. You have a question?
Yeah, kind of relating back to, we want to repeat the idea about the system bus. So those buses actually permit multiple devices, IO devices, to use the same PCI bus at the exact same time, or do they actually have to like wait
for the process? So, typically, a bus is a communication medium. And we'll talk about networks today, which are also communication medium, but network span machines, the bus is the communication medium inside a machine. Okay, now, each device is going to have a unique address, that's the port. Okay, the bus is shared by all the devices. So, only one device can use the bus at any given time. Okay, so if multiple devices want to read or write, they will actually raise a signal saying I request the bus, okay, and then the bus controller will arbitrate saying which device gets priority, and each device will get to go in turn and actually send out. So you have this arbitration logics. SCSI buses do the same thing, PCI bus will do the same thing, USB bus will also do the same. You cannot actually communicate in parallel, okay, because it's a shared medium. Okay, think of people talking. If multiple people start talking at the same time, you basically get collisions. Okay? You cannot hear any one person. So you have to basically do this one at a time. That's what the bus logic controller will do. Okay, let's come back to now caching. So as I already mentioned, you use these buffers on within the OS or on disk to cache frequently accessed data. Okay, and the logic of how caches are used is shown for a read request and write request there. I already mentioned this. If you are trying to read, let's say a block of data from any device, what you will always do is first you will look in the cache. Okay, if that data is already cached in memory, you just return the value in memory. Okay, that's called a cache hit. Okay, cache hit essentially means the data you are looking for is already in the cache. Okay? And if you have a cache miss, which means that data you access is not in the cache, you will actually send that request off to the device. In this case, the device is a disk, so you will read the sector or the block. We'll bring that data and put it in the cache for any subsequent use and also return it to the user. Okay? So that's how read requests are serviced when there's a cache sitting between the device and the user process. Okay, as far as the write request is concerned, what you will do is if you want to try to write a block of data to your device, you are first going to go and update that in the cache. Okay, and then you will actually go and try to write that block into the disk. Okay, you will basically take that memory buffer and send off an IO request to the disk. The disk will go and perform that IO, and then you will be done. Okay. Now, yes.
For the write example, do you need to do if the block is in memory, or would it just always be update the value in the cache?
That is going to depend on what the caching policy is. If the block is cached, you better update it. Because if you don't update it now, the value on disk is newer than the value. You have an old value of the block. Okay, so this you should do. You are asking an additional question. If it is not in the cache, should I additionally put it in the cache? Right? So if you remove the if, it says always all writes are also put in the cache. Okay? This is not saying that. This is saying if the block is cached, please update it because the data has changed. Okay? Additionally, you could say, should I also put it in the cache for subsequent reads? So that is something you can do depending on the caching policy. Now, as I said, as far as the writes are concerned, there are two caching policies that are typically used to call write through and write back. I don't know if you have heard of these terms. They are universal to caches, regardless of whether the cache is in hardware, if you have L2, L1 caches, or whether this is a cache in software that is maintained by the OS. Okay? What the write through policy says is any write request has to block until it goes through the cache all the way to the disk and is finished, or the disk or whatever I/O device it is, and has finished at that I/O device. Okay? That's called write through. What the write back policy says is take your data, okay, put it in the cache, and return to the user. Okay? And at a later time, asynchronously take that data from the cache and write it back to the device. Okay, is that clear? Write through versus write by. Write through says every write request actually goes through the cache all the way to the disk. Okay, and then you return back to the I/O process saying the write is completed. Write back says let the block only propagate to the cache, update the cache, and then return back to the user and saying that your write is done. And at a later time, take that data and move it to the device or send it off to the device. Yes.
If we're using a DMA disk controller and a write-back policy, can the disk controller handle the portion of that that's actually writing, taking it from memory and writing it to disk while the operating? Will the CPU do something else, or how does that work?
Okay, so write-back and write-through are independent of whether you are using DMA, you are using polling, or you are using interrupts. Okay, all this is saying is the following. Okay, so here this is a good picture. Okay, so user process says write, let's say file write or whatever. So you write something to a file. Okay? This becomes a system call at the OS. Okay, this becomes a write system call. Okay, and so your write system call is going to come to the OS. Okay? The simplest thing that the OS can do is take this data, okay, copy it to the buffer cache, okay, and just have the write system call return saying done. Write is done. This is referred to as write back. You are not waiting for that data to actually go to the disk. You are only writing it to the buffer cache and return. Write through basically says that write it to the cache, issue an I/O request, have it go to the disk, and only when the disk is done should you return back. Okay? Now, in either of these two cases, you can basically work with whether it's DMA or I/O or polling. Okay? What would happen in either of those two cases is first you will copy that data into the kernel memory, which is the buffer cache. Then you will issue a DMA request and tell the DMA controller saying go to this region of the buffer cache, pull that data and put it to disk. Okay? So that is independent of whether you are doing write through or write back in some sense. The DMA in one case, the DMA request is in write through, the DMA request has to be issued immediately as soon as the write comes to the OS because you are waiting for the data to go to disk. In the other case, you are writing it in a lazy fashion. You are going to issue that DMA request later. Okay? But in both cases, you will actually have to do that DMA request.
Okay, so in both cases, you have to do a DMA request, but with write through, you do it now, and with write back, you do it...
Write back, you do it later. Okay?
So it's the kernel that's going to decide to go through at some point and do that?
This is, yes. So
I guess what I'm getting at is with the write-back policy, when do we actually write stuff to disk?
That is decided. So the write-back policy is what will be implemented by the operating system. Right?
Okay.
So a kernel designer has decided on a write-back policy. Like there are write-back policies that say every 30 seconds go and take all the dirty pages in your buffer cache and write them out. Flush them to disk. Okay? Whatever policy has been implemented will get executed in this case. Okay, so that's decided by the kernel design. Okay, now, coming back to write through and write back, you should realize that there is a reliability and performance trade-off here. Write through policies are more reliable. Okay? This is simply because if you actually write to a file, okay, and your request comes back saying your request has been, your write request has finished, okay, but it's only in the buffer cache, it hasn't yet gone to disk, and let's say the power goes off. Okay, your machine basically, you yank the cord or the power goes off, then basically the data is still sitting in volatile RAM and the data is going to disappear. It hasn't gone to disk. So you reboot the machine and you look at the disk and you say that the data I wrote is missing. Okay, it's not yet on disk. Okay, so write through policies will prevent that from happening simply because the write request won't return back to the user until the data has actually gone to disk. So you'll wait for the data to propagate to disk and only then will your request come back. So if you know it's on disk, then at this point, if a write request has finished, you know even with a power outage of any sort, your data will still persist on disk. Okay, it's not going to disappear. Okay. Write back policy, on the other hand, you get better performance. Okay, because you are only copying to into a memory buffer, you are not waiting for that I/O request to finish. So writes will be seemingly faster. Yeah, because all you are doing is actually copying it to a RAM buffer in the OS kernel and returning back to the user. Much, much faster. Right? So, basically you are trading reliability for performance because data has not yet gone to disk. Yes.
So on a shutdown, do we just wait for all write backs to finish or do we actually force a write through?
On a shutdown, the first thing that if you actually issue a shutdown command to any OS, the first thing it will do is flush the buffer cache. So you will actually see this on Linux. It will actually print a message saying flushing buffer cache and it will wait for all the pages to get written out. Okay, if you just hit the power button and turn it off, you are out of luck. All the dirty pages will just disappear. Okay, but if you force a clean shutdown, it will first flush. Okay, it won't change the policy, it's just forcing a flush. Okay. Now, so write back is obviously results in faster writes. But the other thing it also gives you is another performance optimization, which says if you have spatial locality of reference, meaning I write to the same disk block multiple times, okay, I can batch multiple IOs in RAM and then have them be one disk IO on disk. Okay, because let's say I'm appending something to a file. Okay, so basically, let's say this is the end of the file in the block, I append foo to it. And then I append bar to it. And these are individual requests. If you had a write back policy, this block would get returned to the cache and you may wait, let's say, some 30 seconds or a minute before it gets flushed. Within that time, if this block gets an additional write, you just overwrite a RAM block. Okay? And multiple of these requests will just become one eventual disk request. Okay? So you will also get lower I/O and better batching performance. Okay? So you get some performance benefits when you do the write back policy, but at the expense of lower reliability. Okay, so you're trading reliability for performance. Any questions? Write back, write through. What I said here is not specific to operating systems. Any caching policy that you have, whether it's in hardware or software, whether it's in databases or in operating system, if you have a cache, you have to decide, is your cache write through or write back? So this is a universal concept related to any caching policy. I just explained it in the context of the OS buffer cache and the file systems and disks. Okay, but this is going to be the case regardless of where you use caching. Okay, so I'm going to stop there and transition. So that was the spillover from last class as far as I/O subsystem is concerned. So we have covered all of these topics, okay? And we are going to now start the very last one, which is distributed systems. We are done with architecture, overview, processes, threads, synchronizations, deadlocks, memory management, and file systems and I/O. Okay, so all of that is done. And the last topic is basically going to be on distributed systems. Okay, so today I will start that lecture. We have two or three more lectures on distributed systems to go. We will define what are distributed systems. I will do a very quick overview of networking. Yeah, for those of you who have not yet taken 453 or may not be familiar with what a network protocol stack looks like, I will have a three slide not a three lecture, a three slide overview of networking. Okay, and with that background, we will start talking about distributed services. Okay, and basically I'll start with remote procedure calls and RMIs. Okay, this is what you have to also do for your lab. You're building a client server threaded client server application in your lab. So we'll start talking about distributed services and remote procedure calls. In subsequent lectures, we'll talk about distributed file systems and a few other concepts, including a lecture on cloud computing that I promised. Okay? So what is a distributed systems? There are many definitions. The one that I will use here for our classes, it's basically a collection of processors that are interconnected by some communication medium. Okay, the communication medium is typically a network. So this is an abstract view. Okay, so P1 through P5 are processors. Okay, there is an interconnect, which we will call a network in this case. Okay, this allows the processors to communicate with one another through that interconnect. Okay, so a process, set of processors that can talk to one another, communicate with one another. Very abstract definition, we'll see some realizations of that definition in the next slide. So the thing to keep in mind is practically every system that you see today, okay, is distributed in some shape or form, whether it's your laptop, tablet, phone, server, any machine that you see today that has a network interface is part of some distributed system, because applications or processes on that machine can communicate with applications and processes on other machines. So that is basically a very simple definition of what a distributed system is. Okay, so let's peel this definition a little more and look at some different forms of system. Okay. So when you talk about distributed systems, okay, or the very generic definition I gave you there, we can then basically think about what are called tightly coupled system and loosely coupled system. Okay. Tightly coupled systems are also referred to as parallel processing. Okay. In this case, the processors are basically inside a machine, okay, rather than across machine. So if you have I just said you have some processors that can talk to one another through some communication medium. If it so happens that all the processors are in one machine, and they, in fact they also end up sharing the clock and memory, that's called a parallel system. Okay. So again, given what you can buy today, practically any system that you see is a parallel system if it has more than one core. If you have more than one core, multi-core system, this definition is satisfied. Okay, because you have more than one processor, that's a core. Okay, in this case, the communication medium is your system bus. Okay, you have a parallel system, a tightly coupled system. Okay, even basic smartphones are beginning to be multi-core, okay, parallel system. And you compare that to loosely coupled system. This is the traditional distributed for definition of a distributed system. In this case, also you have processors. The processors just happen to be on different machines. Not inside a machine, they are on different machines. The communication medium is an actual network of some sort, whether it's Ethernet or wireless network or cellular network is not material, it's some form of a network. Okay? And so what happens here is the processor is also has its own memory. Memory is not shared across machines. Memory is specific to a single machine. And each processor runs an independent OS. Okay? And the OS doesn't have to be the same. You can have one machine running Mac and another machine running Unix. And so long as they can communicate with one another, that's a distributed system. Okay? They're heterogeneous in some sense. Okay? These are called loosely coupled distributed systems. Okay. Much of our emphasis is going to be on, when I talk about distributed systems in the next few classes, is going to be on this class of distributed system. We are not going to talk about parallel system. Okay. There are many techniques that are used to develop applications on parallel systems. How do you write applications to run well on multi-core? They use forms of threading or inter-process communications of some sort. We will not go there. Okay. We are going to focus on this aspect. Yes.
So, for example, a warehouse server farm running some gigantic, thousands of machines serving up some basic web service, that would be loosely coupled?
Yes. So, if you have a data center with racks of servers, Okay, they all work together. So search engine is a good example. Right? Google search engine is wide, highly distributed. Okay, not runs on thousands and thousands of machines. Okay? Each machine is its own processor. Okay? Has its own memory, runs its own independent OS. They are communicating with one another. Okay? Within that data center, they will have LAN. They also communicate across data center or wide area network. That will be loosely coupled. Okay? It is traditional distributed systems. Okay? If you have a supercomputing node where you have a single machine which has multiple processors, that will come under the rubric of parallel computing. A big machine, but lots of cores inside a single machine. Okay. So why think of or design systems in this way? There are many advantages to designing distributed systems. I will describe four. Okay? The first one is resource sharing. Okay? The single most biggest advantage of distributed systems is because processors can communicate. And because they are connected over a network, you can share resources. Okay? A machine or a processor can share a resource on another machine. Okay? Simplest way, example I can give you is a network printer. Okay? You have a printer, you connect it to one machine. You can share that printer to other machines. You can then have other machines print to that printer, even though those machines don't have that dedicated print. Okay? This is just simply enabled because machine 1 can send a print job to machine 2 over a network, and the printer attached to machine 2 can then print. Right? So that's one example. Another simple example is what distributed file systems. Right? Machine A can access a file stored on machine B. Okay? The file doesn't have to be local to your disk. You can actually run a distributed or a network file system and access files stored on another machine. Okay? If you use network volume, network shares, network drives, they are all distributed file system. They all allow you to access data or files stored on a server somewhere. Okay? That is enabled. That's a form of resource sharing. You are actually in one case sharing files, in another case you are sharing a hardware device like a printer. Okay? So that's a big advantage of having systems be distributed. Second example, or not example, advantage is computational speed up. Okay? If you have n processors that are part of a distributed system and collectively they execute or run as application, some application, then potentially this application is going to get an n times speed up than if it was running on a single processor. Okay? You can think of an app that is running on a single processor. Now you take that app and you distribute it across n machines. Okay? If you design your app well, because you can run it on n machines, you can harness the computational power of these n processors and potentially get n times speed up. Okay? This is the example that was being mentioned earlier, where you have racks of servers, lots and lots of servers that collectively work on some application. In this case, I mentioned the Google search engine. Okay, distributed across tens of thousands of machines. They're harnessing all of that compute power. Okay, you can't simply run something of that scale on a single machine. Okay, the data won't fit, neither can the computation be sustained by a single machine. Okay? Now, to implement applications in this way, okay, you need to be able to decompose your problem into sub-problems and have each processor work on these sub-problems, and then they coordinate with one another to solve the bigger problem. Okay, so just as you took a centralized application and you made it multi-threaded, when we talked about threading, whether it was a reader-writer or some other forms of multi-threaded application, so can you take a single address space application and make it distributed. Okay, you can now partition it on multiple machines, have these processes communicate with one another and solve some larger problem. Okay? So long as you can write your applications in this way, you can get your advantage of this speed up. Okay. Third advantage is reliability. Okay? Simply because you have the advantage of running your application on multiple processors, you can actually also replicate either the computation or the data on multiple machines. You can create copies of your data. You can run the same task on multiple machines. Right? And what this gives you is higher reliability. One machine goes down, it crashes, or the hardware experiences a failure, your system as a whole doesn't have to stop functioning. Right? It continues to run. Key advantage of a distributed system. If you had a single node system, a centralized system, your machine goes down, your service goes down. You have a website running on one machine, your machine crashes, your website is down. You replicate your website on multiple machines, one machine goes down, the requests that are coming to that website can still be serviced by other machines. Your website continues to be up. Simple, but another key advantage. Most distributed services that have high reliability needs will use replication to get higher forms of reliability. You don't see Google go down because three machines failed somewhere. In fact, entire data centers can go down and still the service continues to run because it's replicated across. So well-designed distributed systems can actually run even though there may be large numbers of servers that are down at any given time. Big advantage. Yeah, communication is another advantage, and by communication I mean actually it allows people to communicate, not machines to communicate. You can send email messages, you can communicate using online social networks, you can use chat or text messages. All of these communication enabled by distributed systems that are running somewhere. Yeah, so that's another advantage. Okay. So those are all the good things, okay, now the for advantages, but designing distributed systems is also more challenging than designing centralized systems. Just as writing multi-threaded programs are more challenging than writing single-threaded programs. You have to think of parallelism, here you have to think of distribution. Okay. So several things get harder, okay, and you have to deal with several design issues. You have to worry about how are you going to communicate. Since these applications or processes communicate with one another, you have to decide how the communication is going to occur. You have to decide on issues like transparency. I'll talk about that in just a minute. Security, reliability, performance, and programming model. Transparency basically says how visible are you going to make the fact that your application is distributed to your end users. If you hide the fact that there are actually many machines on which this application is distributed, you have what is called transparency. Okay. Google is a good example. Okay. All that is exposing to you is a search box. Okay. It doesn't say, go connect to the 1,000th server in this machine and then send your search query there. You just type your search query and somehow your search query goes to some machine somewhere, it gets your results and gives it back to you. You don't know that there are thousands of machines that are participating in the search engine. You don't know which search machine actually serviced your query. Okay? Neither should you. Okay? All of that is hidden. Okay? You could have designed it some other way, saying you are actually sending this query from Amherst, Massachusetts, so go to the closest server for Google, which may be in Boston, and then connect to that machine, send your query there and get your result. If Google made you do that, you would probably not search much at all because it was very cumbersome to do. Okay? So designing systems where that hide a lot of this complexity, make things transparent, increases usability. Okay? This is a design goal. It would make things as transparent as possible, not expose unnecessary details to users and make their tasks more complex. Okay? Security is another problem, okay? Because now machines are on a network. Okay? Good guys can access them as well as the bad. Okay? So people can hack into machines, they can steal your data, they can tamper with things and whatnot. Okay? So when you have distributed systems, you have to actually ensure that your applications are secure, your systems are secure. This makes your job more complex as a distributed systems designer. Okay? You have to worry about what if somebody does something bad. They send something to my application that was unintended and cause it to crash or tamper with it, data and so on. Reliability, I already mentioned. You do get the benefits of reliability, but it's not automatic. Okay, you have to build your application to take advantage of reliability. You have to decide every data that I store in my application is going to be replicated on three different machines. You have to implement all of this in your application. It's not automated. So you get the benefits, but it increases your design complexity. Okay, I said you get performance and scalability. Okay, you have to write your algorithms well so they can distribute, they can scale smoothly. Okay. And the programming model. Okay, what application programming model are you going to use to implement your distributed system? Okay, we'll talk about one such model today, which is remote procedure call. There are many different ways to implement distributed applications. You can start with socket programming. You just use vanilla network sockets and write application. You can write it at a very high level where a lot of these details are hidden. Here we'll talk about RPCs where you don't worry about mundane networking details. So system takes care of it for you. So you work at a higher level of abstraction. Okay? It matters how you write your applications. Okay, So these are all the things that get harder. Okay, we studied a whole bunch of these things except for the first two. Okay? Resource sharing is enabled, but again, there's more complexity. Okay? Timing and synchronization is a big problem. Okay? Because I said, in loosely coupled distributed systems, each machine has its own processor and hence has its own clock. Okay? And typically, clocks will never be perfectly synchronous. Biggest problem in any distributed systems is clocks across machines are never perfectly synchronized. They will be off a little bit. Okay? So you can't simply do things that you could have done well on a single machine. I'll give you an example. I presume many of you have used Make to build application. Okay? So what Make does is it's a utility that does incremental compilation. If you have, let's say, a project with 5 source files, you just modify one, you just change one, and you want to recompile it. What Make will do is it will only recompile the files that have changed since the last compilation. Okay? The way it does is it checks timestamps. It says when is the source file modified and when was the corresponding object file generated. The source file is newer than the object file, then the source has changed. Since you compiled it last, you regenerate the object file. The source file is older than the object file. You know that you generated the object file after the last change, so there is no need to recompile it. Okay? Now, if you do any programming on a distributed system, you will see that Make doesn't work very well because files are not synchronized. Clocks are not synchronized. You may actually go to machine 1 and you may modify a source file on a browser, on an editor, and you save it. Okay? It's going to get a timestamp saying this is the time you change. You go to another machine, which frequently happens, the machine that does the builds are different from machines that you compile or write your code. So you go to another machine and you type Make. If that clock is off with respect to this clock, it will actually think that the file has not changed at all. Yeah, because the clocks are off, and when you compare timestamps, they're not directly comparable. Okay, you can only compare timestamps if they came from the same clock. But if the clocks are off, then you may actually get incorrect results. Okay. So synchronization, big problem. Yeah, and distributed system. So if you write any application that critically depends on timestamps, right, you better be sure that you wrote your application well, because it's very likely it will not work. Unless you have a clock synchronization protocol that is actually running on these machines, actually synchronizing their clocks. Otherwise, you are going to be in big trouble. Okay? So, we won't talk about synchronization in this class, but it's something that we always talk about when we have a more detailed discussion of distributed system. Okay? And there are these other issues that also get more complicated. Critical sections. Okay? When you have multiple processes on multiple machines that are trying to work on a data object, you have to do the same kind of synchronization you did in a multi-threaded program. Okay, but now locks, you cannot assume that you will have a lock on one machine. It's meaningless to another machine. Okay? So you have to make the concept of locks distributed. You have to implement distributed locks. Okay, so that this notion of a lock carries over across machines. Okay, you can have multiple processes trying to acquire a lock. Deadlock detection and recovery is also harder because processes are spread out on multiple machines. Okay, how do you know whether there's a deadlock? unless you go to all these machines and figure out which are the applications, what resources are they holding, is there a cycle, okay, coordinating this across tens or hundreds of machines, very complicated. Okay. And failure recovery, okay, machines fail, you have to eventually fix them, okay, and you have to recover the data and get back to where you were. Okay. So all of those tasks become harder. Okay. That's a quick introduction to distributed system design, the broad definitions and advantages and disadvantages. Okay, what I'll do now is actually do a four slide review of networking, okay, and then we'll come back with that background and start talking about remote procedure calls and RPS. Okay, so if you have done 453 already or are taking it, all of this is some material you know, but if not, you can basically get a quick overview of networking. Okay. So networking is, in this case, the reason we are doing this is, I said distributed systems consist of processors that communicate over a communication medium. And typically that medium is a network. Okay, so we'll define what that network means. Okay. So network is, as I said, a communication medium. And there are typically two kinds of networks that you encounter. What is called a local area network or a wide area network. Okay. Local area network essentially connects machines, let's say within a same building or within a campus. Okay. These are networks that only go small distances. Okay. Wide area networks, on the other hand, are networks that go very large distances. Okay. So these are in fibers that you see going from one continent to another or one end of the country to another. So those are called wide area networks. So these networks span much larger geographies. And depending on whether you are building a local area network or wide area network, you will have different technologies. Okay? LAN technologies include Ethernet, Wi-Fi. It may include some other forms of Bluetooth is another example of, you can make a Bluetooth LAN, for example. So these are all short distance networks, networks that span small distances. Typically they are fast. You will have gigabit Ethernet or 10 gigabit Ethernet. You may have Wi-Fi that goes to 150 megabits per second. Typically fast, short distances, but fast. Okay. Wide area networks use different technologies. They may use optical fiber technologies or other kinds of techniques. Or if you have cellular networks, they also go long distances. You may have microwave links, yeah, that go tens or hundreds of miles. Okay. They go longer distances, but they're also slower than local area networks. You may have much slower speeds that may only go megabits, tens of megabits. The fastest ones go hundreds of megabits. Okay? Here you're tens of gigabits already, and they keep speeds keep increasing, of course. Okay? Now, typically the way networks work is you take LAN networks and you connect them up over WAN networks. Okay? And this basically gives you the internet. Internet is a network of networks. So what you will have is, you have, let's say, a LAN at UMass. You may have a LAN in your home, which may be a Wi-Fi, or your dorm, which may be a Wi-Fi router. Okay, and there's a WAN connecting them. Okay, that may be your ISP. If you have a cable company, for instance, that may be Comcast or AT&T or some other company. And so collectively you have lots of these networks that are LAN networks that are having WAN interconnect. And these networks are collectively today called the internet. Okay. So how do networks work? So basically they work by allowing applications or processes to send messages bit from one machine or one process to another machine and another process. Okay. These messages are called packets in networking terminology. Okay. So basically what happens is, you send a message, it gets you construct a packet. The packet actually goes out of your machine, it traverses the network, that packet reaches another machine, eventually the destination machine, and then it goes from the OS to the process it is destined for, and your message is going to reach the other process you are trying to talk to. Okay? So packets are sent through the network. Okay? And as they go from the source to the destination, they may traverse what are called multiple hops. They may go to intermediate nodes, which are called routers. Okay? So routers are responsible for forwarding packets. So you may have let's say a machine, let's say your laptop. And here you have a server. Okay, that server, let's say, is running a website. Okay, let's say CNN.com. Okay, you have a browser here. Okay, if you try to access this CNN web page, you'll construct a packet. In this case, it's a HTTP packet. Okay, it's going to go out over the network. This is going to be a wide area network. And there's no direct connection from, no wire going directly from your machine to the CNN server, obviously. Okay, so it's going to go through intermediate nodes that keep forwarding it, and these are called routers. Okay. And each router forwards the message to another router and so on until it reaches the destination. Okay. You probably heard of routers. You probably have one if you have a Wi-Fi network at home. That is your edge router in your home. Okay. That router talks to another router in your ISP, which may have a lot more, and each router keeps forwarding your packets until it goes from your source machine to the destination machine. Okay. The only thing that routers do is forwarding. Okay. They do packet forwarding. That's their primary goal. Okay? So that's basically how packets go from source to destination. Now we'll talk a little bit about protocols. Okay, what is a protocol? A protocol is a set of rules that parties agree to for communication. Yeah, to communicate, you have to agree on some rules. Yeah, and in the case of machines, these rules are referred to as network protocols. Yeah. If you look at the typical networking stack inside an operating system, you will see that there are many protocols that are supported. In fact, these protocols are organized in the form of a networking stack. Yeah. And there are layers in this stack. Yeah, when I was talking about OS kernel design, I said, networking stack is the only part of the kernel that uses layered design. A layered design is where each layer can only talk to the layer above it and layer below it. Right? And this is an organization of a protocol stack that does precisely that. Okay? So packets originate at an application. They are given to the OS. They traverse down the protocol stack. Each of these layers does some processing to that packet. Keep sending it to the layer below it until you reach what is called the physical layer. That's your network itself. And then you send it off. That goes outside the machine and it gets forwarded. It reaches the other end. And then it traverses up the protocol stack. It's processed again until it's given to the application. Okay. Each of these layers implements a certain protocol. I'll show you the protocol stack for TCP/IP. Okay. So in the TCP/IP protocol stack, this is the most common one. Here you have a set of layers. Okay, so you have what is called a physical layer. Physical layer is basically the wire or the physical medium you're using for communication. If you have Wi-Fi, the physical medium is air. Your packets are actually going wireless. Okay? If you have an Ethernet, your physical medium is the wire that you're plugged into your machine. Okay? If you are using your smartphone, again it's air, but you are using cellular protocols in that case. That's the physical medium. The data link layer is basically either Ethernet or it could be Wi-Fi, or it's the protocol that is used at the lowest layer of the protocol stack. Whether you are using Ethernet protocol, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, 3G, 4G, they are all at the very lowest layer of the protocol software protocol stack. Okay, that's the data link layer. The routing layer is called IP in TCP/IP. IP stands for Internet Protocol. Okay. The layer above it is called the transport layer. Okay, that's where either TCP or UDP sit. Okay, so that's called the transport layer. And above them are a lot of application layer protocols, the ones that you may be familiar with. Okay, that's FTP, HTTP, SMTP. SMTP is what you use for email. You have HTTP is, of course, the web. You may have a whole bunch of those at that layer, depending on what application you're using. Okay? And processes actually use those protocols to send packets. Okay, so that's basically what a protocol stack does. I'll only mention two things. First thing is IP is the routing protocol within the TCP/IP stack. Okay? It runs on every router. It helps you route packets or forward packets. Okay? It's called a network layer protocol. Okay? TCP, and it's also called hop by hop protocol. And each node IP decides where to send the packet next, which router to send it to. What TCP is, it operates from on an end-to-end basis. Okay, TCP operates on the source and the destination machine, and it is responsible for things like reliability. Okay. TCP is what's called a reliable protocol. Okay, so if you send a packet, it is likely that sometimes the packet reaches the destination and sometimes it doesn't. Okay. So packets may get lost during in transit. Okay, if packets get lost, then TCP can actually has to decide which packets are lost and do retransmission. Okay, things like this. Okay, so from an application standpoint, you don't have to worry about protocol dropping packets and so on and so forth. Okay. So this is a typical packet, what it looks like in terms of its structure. Okay, so this is the data part of the packet, it's called the payload, and then there are a number of things called headers. Headers are extra information you tack onto the data that tells the network where this packet is supposed to go to. Okay, the typical fields in the header include the source address and the destination address of a packet and many other things like what protocol you are using and so on and so forth. Okay? Alright, so that's our three or four slide overview. I'm going to stop here for a minute to see if there are questions, because I'm assuming that you know all this. Okay? You are going to write lab 3 assuming you know all this. If you don't, I just did the 4 slide overview, so now you know. Okay, so let me pause and ask questions, because I'm going to start RPC, which assume you now know what TCP/IP is and what protocols are and what networking is and so on and so forth. Any questions or anything I should re-emphasize as far as networking concepts are concerned? No? Okay. Okay, so if there are no questions, let's start talking about designing distributed systems. We'll talk about client-server model and RPCs. So the most common way of constructing a distributed application is referred to as the client-server model. This involves taking your larger application and partitioning it into two pieces called a client piece and a server piece. Okay. The server part of your application includes processes that will provide some service. Okay. If you have a web server, that provides web service. If you have a mail server, it provides mail service. Okay. You may have lots of different kinds of servers. You may have a file server, provides file service. A print server provides print service. Okay. So that's the server side of your application. The client side of your application is the part of the application that is requesting the service from the server. So you may have, let's say, a web browser is the client part in a web in a client server model of the web. Web browsers are client, web servers are the server part of it. Okay. So browsers make web requests, they make HTTP requests. Okay. Web servers service the HTTP request by sending the requested data, whether it's a web page, it's an image or whatever it is. Okay. So this is how you typically write is a very common way of writing a distributed application. It's a client-server model. Okay? There's another model, which I will not talk about in this class. It's called the peer-to-peer model. It's called the P2P model. Okay? There are many applications that use the P2P models, which we will not worry about here. We'll only talk about client-server model. Okay? So client is a program that uses the service. The server is a process or a collection of processes that provide some services. Okay. Typically, how you write this application is the client has to establish a connection to the server. Okay. It needs to know the address of the server. It needs to establish a connection using, let's say, TCP. Right. I just talked about TCP/IP. So you will basically make a connection, and then you will send a request to the server. Okay. So you may first, if you want a browser to get a page, web page from a web server, you will first make a TCP connection, and then over that TCP connection, you will send an HTTP request. HTTP request is that URL that you type in a browser. www.cnn.com/index.html. That string is your HTTP request. That string is actually sent off to the server. Okay? The server will receive that string, and that's the request that the browser has made. It will then get the requested page for you and send that page back to you. Okay? Your browser will then see the page, render it, and display it. Okay? So clients send requests after connecting to the server. The server processes the request, sends back a response, and then the connection is done. Okay? There are many ways to implement this form of client-server applications, and we'll talk about one such method today, which is remote procedure calls. Okay? This is a higher level method to implement client-server application. It makes your job as programmer much easier. You don't really have to worry too much about the networking details when you write your applications in this form. Okay, this is also what you are going to use for your last lab, although you will use RPCs in the context of Java. They are called RMIs, remote methods, not remote procedures. Let me first explain the example, or not example, the concept. Okay, so what is a remote procedure call? So this is a client, this is a server, this is the network. Okay. Client is running a process. Okay, I'm just going to write as a main remote procedure calls are a way for a client to make a request on a server by simply calling a function or a method. So you write a typical RPC application just as you would write centralized application. You just call, you structure your entire application into methods or functions, and clients are just going to call functions. Well, the only difference is the function that the client is calling doesn't happen to be in the address space of the client. It's a function that resides on the server. So in this case, I just showed you a main program with main, and it's calling function foo. Okay. This is how you would actually write this application. Okay. Now, as far as the distributed application is concerned, the code for foo doesn't reside on this machine. It's actually sitting here. It's executing here. So what will happen in an RPC is this invocation of foo will trigger a message that will go over the network saying client has called foo. Okay, this packet is going to traverse here. It's going to come to the server. The server is going to receive this request saying the client has invoked foo, and it will execute foo at the server and send back the results. Okay, so you can, of course, send some arguments. So the arguments will go with the message. It will traverse, go to the server. The server will take the arguments, execute the method, and send back the reply. Is that clear what I just said? So remote procedure calls are a way by which a client can invoke procedures or call procedures, except that those procedures are not local to that machine. They are implemented remotely on some other machine. Yes, question. Yes, so there are lots of things I did not describe as to how all this is happening. Right? How do you know where the server is? I didn't say when you call foo, the programmer actually doesn't explicitly say where the server resides. You don't have to say what is the IP address of the server. You don't actually, I didn't say you have to establish a connection to the server. All that is happening for you automatically. There is a lot of underlying code that actually gets automatically written for you. Okay? This is why it's so simple. If you have to actually program this at a very low socket level, you would have to write a function that says, first line is go establish a connection to the server. Okay? You will say create a socket, bind to the socket, connect that connect to the server. You do all this networking first, and then you can send a request over that connection. When you write RPCs, you don't deal with all this. Okay? You just call methods. Something underneath takes care of all the details for you. Okay? right? It figures out where is the server, it figures out how to construct this message, how to establish a connection. All this is done for you internally. Okay? So a lot of this complexity is taken away from the programmer. Okay? You just write this code as if you are writing a centralized program. You just call methods. And you know how to write a program with multiple methods. You just call methods. It just so happens that the method is not local, it's remote, but it doesn't change how you write the code. You just call the method. Something else is doing all the magic for you. Right? It's taking care of the details of sending requests over a network and so on and so forth. So this concept is referred to as a remote procedure. You're invoking a remote function. As if you are invoking a local function. Okay, so you write your code as just as you write your centralized application, except that some procedures are no longer local to your process. They are remote and they sit on some other machine. Okay. Now there are several things you have to do as far as implementing an RPC system is concerned. What I showed you here is what the user programmer or the user or the application programmer is going to write. But underneath this is what is an RPC system. This is the OS part. Okay, that is going to take this and do all of this, sending things over the network and so on. Okay, so we will also talk a little bit about what is happening underneath. Okay, what is inside an RPC system. Okay, typically what happens is every procedure, every remote procedure has a signature. Okay, the signature is registered with, as we'll see, a naming service. And when you compile this code, compile the client and the server code, your compiler is going to generate additional code for you that is going to do all of the networking. Okay? That code is referred to as a stub code. Okay? This code is automatically generated. And then you just basically take that code, your code, and you link it together, you get a binary. Now, clearly, you don't compile this to a typical compiler. You need a special compiler to compile RPC code. Okay, you will not run this through GCC, for instance. You will call a special compiler called RPCGen, which will generate all that code for you, which in turn will call a GCC compiler. Same with Java. Okay, you will basically call a special compiler that will spit out additional code that will do all of that networking for you. Okay, same concept is true in Java. In Java, the notion of remote procedures are called remote methods. Okay, so you have what is called RMI or remote method invocation. That is exactly what you will be using for your lab. Okay. So what will happen there is you will basically call a method on an object. So you may call object.foo. It is just that this object and all this method and data reside on another machine. Okay, so this is your object. And this is foo in that object. Okay. So you are making a method call on an object that resides on another machine. Typically, until now, you have assumed that all object instances reside within your same address space, within the JVM. Okay, now, some objects will no longer reside on in your address space. They will reside on other address spaces on other machines. Okay, you can basically invoke methods on those objects. Okay. Same thing is true. You will actually write the code as if you are writing normal Java code with very small changes. There's a compiler that will generate a lot of that additional stub code for you, and then your program will work as if you are invoking local methods, except that they are not. Okay. This is basically what a stub code is actually going to do. Okay, when you call this remote procedure foo, or a remote method foo, your stub code, the compiler generated code, has to do all of these things. Okay, it has to first create a message. Okay, it has to send that message over the network. It has to wait for the response. It has to unpack the reply and it has to return the results back to whatever process called this remote method. Sounds fairly straightforward, but it's not as simple as it seems, primarily because the one thing that you do not assume in any remote procedure calls or in RMI is that the server is going to be the same platform as the client. You may be making the call from Windows, the server may be running Linux, you may be making the call from a big Indian machine, the server may be a little Indian machine, doesn't matter, it has to work. Okay, because I never said anywhere that in a distributed system all machines are alike. just that they are processors that are connected by network. They could be heterogeneous processors. Yeah, some processors may be running different processors may be running different operating systems. So that is something that an RPC system has to be built for. So all of this stuff has to work regardless of the platform. The messaging has to work. The processing has to work. Whether it's big Indian, little Indian, 32-bit, 64-bit. All of those ugly details actually have to be dealt with by the stub code. Yeah, so if you actually write an RPC system and you actually look at a subcode, you'll see a lot of code. They're doing a lot of ugly stuff that you are saved from writing. Typically, you would have to do that if you are writing all of this at a lower level. Okay? This is what's happening on the server end. Okay? Server end is a stub code that just sits in a loop. Okay? It's an infinite loop that just sits and waits for a command to arrive over a network. This is a remote procedure invocation. Okay, once the command comes in, it will unpack, it will find out what method is being invoked, it will take all the parameters that have come over the network, you unpack the parameters, and then the stub code is actually going to call the method for you, okay, for this client process. So you call the procedure, okay, you build the reply, okay, so the results come back from the procedure, you make a reply message with the results, you send it back, okay, and then you loop. Okay. Now, one additional detail that the cluster or server stub does is it could be multi-threaded, something that you also have to assume in your lab. Okay? Because multiple clients can make requests of the server at the same time. You can't assume that requests are going to come sequentially. If you have a web server, you can't assume that there can be only one connection that some browser can make at a time. Any number of browsers can connect to that web server all at once. The way it's handled at the server end is every request is given a thread. An invocation of a procedure comes in, you create a thread, and then you basically have that thread process your request. Okay, so typically servers are going to be multi-threaded. The threading is also in many cases taken care of for you by the stub code. You are not creating threads in that code. But each request will fork off its own thread. Okay. Any questions on this? I'll show you some sample code in just a minute, but let's ask a few questions. Okay. So first of all, in all of this discussion, I did not say anything about the networking aspects. I did not even say how does the client know where the server is when you are running your client process. Typically, you will have to have a way by which you locate the server. Either you hardcode the server address somewhere, saying that the server is always going to run here, but you don't want to do that because you want to keep the code clean. So you will have to use a lookup service to figure out where is the server running. So when you actually call this method remote procedure foo, you are going to a neighbor saving service and saying, there is a server that implements the service foo. That's a good question. I was talking about transparency earlier, where in the server farm you don't actually tell the user on client which machine to check and so on. Here you have a good form of transparency. You did not actually have to hard code the IP address of the machine and so on. Something figured that out for you at runtime. Programmer didn't have to deal with it. So there is a form of transparency here. If you are writing socket code, you would actually say, kind of create a socket and then bind to a socket, you will actually specify the IP address and so on and so forth. That's not being done. Okay, so you're programming at a much higher level. Okay. So basically what happens is that a binding, which is finding where the server is, can be done statically, which is typically not done, but most of the time it's done dynamically through and what is called a naming service. Naming service is a lookup service. Okay? So you do a directory lookup saying which server supports this method foo. Okay, so you look that up. It's like you looking up yellow pages, right? I want to find a plumber. It's the same thing. Okay, who is going to implement this? So, and then the server will tell you, and then you do the binding. Okay, so we have 2 minutes. So I'll just talk a little bit about, or try to make it a little more real. Okay. So the same concept is also implemented in Java out of the box. In C and C++, you do have RPC support in most operating system, and Java is part of the language. Okay, so in Java, this concept is called remote method invocation. We're invoking remote methods on remote objects. Okay, so I'll come back next time and talk a little bit about this, but that is maybe easier if I show you a little bit of code. Okay, so this is the Hello. It's a client-server application that implements a Hello World interface. Okay, you just send a request to the server, and the server sends you Hello World as a string, okay, over a network. Okay, so this is the interface that you define. Okay, so this says this is your class called Hello, and that basically says it's a remote method. Okay, java.rmi.remote says that this class is going to implement some remote methods. Okay, and this is the only remote method that you have implemented. This is a method that a client will call. Client will just say object.sayHello. And that method is actually have to come to the server for processing. Okay, so this is the interface for the server saying that's the method, and it's going to throw an exception. Yes, your question.
I'm just
going to
have a DNS record. Please find this particular method at test.com kind of thing.
Yes, so I'll show you some code to do exactly that. This is basically the implementation of the Hello World server. We'll come back to this again next time. Okay, so that's the method. Okay, all it is doing is returning a string. That's the Hello World string, okay, and this is basically how you make it a remote object. You call, you say extends remote unicast remote object, and it's going to become a remote method. Okay, so now question was asked about how are you going to bind it. So that is basically here. Okay, so you are going to basically since you are a server, you have to register with the naming service saying I am a server, I implement the Hello the say Hello method. Okay. This is what you are going to call, the naming you are going to call. That procedure is called binding, registering with the directory service. So you will, when you start the server, it will basically go and, so first you will create a object, okay, that will implement that method. That's your object here. And then you are registering that object with your naming service. Okay. So here is your Hello World client, which is very straightforward. Yeah, there's not much here. All you are going to do is you are going to do a lookup. You could ask the naming service saying, tell me a server that actually implements this Hello World service. Okay. And then you are going to get back. So you have not defined this a priori. Okay. When you code, you are not saying this is the IP address, none of that. All you will do is at runtime, you will basically say which machine or which service is currently registered that implements this, and you just get that back. And then all you are doing is you say object.sayHello. Okay. And object.sayHello is actually your remote method. Okay. That method doesn't live on the client machine, it lives on the server machine. So that is going to trigger all of the networking for you. Okay. As you will see here, there is no networking at all. You did not set up a connection to the server, you did not create packets, you didn't do any of that. Okay. All of that is done for you by the RMI system at runtime. So you are doing network programming without actually touching the low-level aspects of network program. So it simplifies a lot of things for you. Okay, all you do is you register with the name service, you look up a name service, and you just invoke methods, and then that's it. Okay. So that's the client. All you are doing is you are calling object hello. That request is going to go over this network, execute that method, and send. You will get that string back that you are going to display. So I just wanted to show this for those of you who are trying to get an early start on your lab 3 because you are doing RMI programming in there. Okay? This is what it is going to look like. So when you go through those tutorials, keep these concepts in mind. Try to understand what the tutorial is saying and then go start writing code for your lab. Okay? So I'll have more to say about this next time, but this is a good place to stop.
Okay.